Hello, friends, and welcome to the third episode of the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. I'm your host, Nate Laux, and I'm excited to bring you today's lineup of conversations. Our journey through the heart and the soul of LaPorte continues thanks to the amazing support of our listeners like you and our faithful sponsor, the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership. Our goal is to keep our community connected by providing helpful information and having meaningful conversations. And we're grateful for the warm reception and enthusiasm shown for our first two episodes. It motivates us to bring even more compelling stories and interviews and conversations directly to you. Now, if you haven't already, please subscribe, review, and rate our podcast to help us reach even more listeners. And most importantly, please share this conversation with others who are interested in staying informed about what's happening in LaPorte, Indiana. Thanks again for your support. Today, our focus is on education, community vitality, and civic engagement. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Peggy Hinckley, the interim superintendent of the LaPorte Community School Corporation. We discussed her professional and her personal journey, comparing her previous and current roles as the superintendent and now interim superintendent of the LaPorte Community School Corporation. We also addressed the current challenges facing our local schools, including budgetary constraints and difficult decisions regarding school closures. If you've been paying attention, you've probably heard of the kerfluffle that happened at the Kingsford Heights Elementary. I must say that while our local school system does have issues that need to be addressed, and we do nobody any favors by ignoring those issues, after our conversation, I felt more hopeful than I had in a long time that these issues are not insurmountable. This conversation promised to provide both insight and hopefully inspiration for those of you that are also a little anxious about what's going on. But that's not all. The heart of any city lies in its communal spaces and gatherings, where we can get to know others and be known by others as neighbors and friends. To paint that picture, I spoke with Brett Benversi, the Civic and Events Director for the City of LaPorte. Brett is in the studio to share the details on upcoming events at our beloved Civic Auditorium and give a glimpse into the exciting upgrades and future plans for this iconic venue. I always love talking to Brett about events that we can look forward to in the future here in LaPorte. As election season is approaching, we are discussing the important matter of voting with LaPorte County Clerk Heather Stevens. Heather will provide us with information on the voting process, kind of where to go, updates on voting centers, which is new this year, and the measures being taken to ensure the security and trustworthiness of our elections, despite any doubts that may be circulating within our community. And this is a necessary listen for all well-informed voters. As we prepare for an episode filled with curiosity and connections, and of course, diving deep into the heart of LaPorte, let's remember that our conversations are meant to open doors to understanding and hopefully provide some more insights than you might find elsewhere, ultimately strengthening the fabric of our community. The more we know, the better we are for and to each other. So stay with us, engage with us, and let's keep the energy alive. Are you ready to dive in? I know I am. I'm excited about this episode. So let's get curious, connected, and plugged into every corner of LaPorte together for the third episode of the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. Here we go. Welcome back to the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. We're exploring the stories and issues that are important to those that live, work, and enjoy being in LaPorte, Indiana. Today we have a special episode discussing the future of education in LaPorte. You had to be unaware not to have heard about the stories and rumors surrounding the local school system. Our guest today is Dr. Peggy Hinckley, who is the interim superintendent for the LaPorte Community School Corporation. Dr. Hinckley is taking on the role during a crucial time of change following the retirement of the longtime superintendent Mark Francesconi. She has a great amount of experience and insight that will be valuable in navigating the challenges ahead that all of us have. Now, our school corporation is currently facing challenges that will shape our educational landscape for years to come. One major challenge is the budget issues that require immediate and thoughtful strategies that Peggy and our school board are going to be navigating the next days and weeks and months ahead. And the recent controversy around Kingsford Heights Elementary, where the initial announcement of closure was later rescinded, kind of rumors and things like that was talked about, and it's caused some strong reactions in the community. The state of Indiana has also started many years ago an open enrollment policy where tax dollars can be used for students to attend public or even private schools outside of their designated district. This policy has impacted LaPorte schools, as many residents have chosen to send their children to schools in neighboring districts, resulting in a significant loss of revenue for our school corporation. If you want to know more about that, I encourage you to watch the last school board meeting. You can find that on YouTube, where school board president Ryan Seaberg talks about that in detail. So these critical issues and more will be discussed as we try to understand the vision and plans of Dr. Hinckley and the school board, her perspective not only to address immediate challenges, but also provide insight into the broader horizon of education in LaPorte. This is undoubtedly going to help all of us understand what to expect and how to adapt and support and thrive as a community. So without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Peggy Hinckley to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming with us.
Thank you. And I do want to let your listeners know I was the permanent superintendent here from 1989 to 2001. So I'm kind of an oldie but goodie. But it has been 23 years. So perhaps people may not remember that. So, but this was a great experience for me. My daughter is a graduate of LaPorte High School. I raised her here. So
that's a great segue into this. So I want to talk a little bit about your background then. I assume, like most superintendents and principals and administrators, you started as an educator. Is that right?
Oh, of course. I was an elementary school teacher in Lake County. There's a school district called River Forest, very small. Uh-huh. And I taught first grade and fourth grade. And if you can teach first graders, you can do about anything.
You can, kidding.
Because they're lovely. And then I went into administration after that, and I was in that district 15 years, including 5 years as a superintendent. And then I came to LaPorte, and then after I left LaPorte in 2001, I went to the Metropolitan School District of Warren Township. People would know it as Warren Central High School, about 12,000 students, and I was there 11 years. And then I retired the first time, and then I was working as school improvement consultant, but I was the interim superintendent for the Indianapolis Public Schools in 2013, and then I was still doing school improvement consulting, and then I was born in Gary, and so when the state took over Gary's schools in 2017, the person who was going to be the emergency manager had to be a superintendent license, and I live in Lake County, and so they were knocking my door down, and it was an interesting experience, but I felt called to serve, and so I served 16 months there before my husband Mark finally said it's time to stop, and so that was in. He passed away in September, and so I was getting a little, I got to have purpose, and then here came LaPorte, so that's why I'm here.
So you're back into LaPorte, and obviously as the interim, is it fair to say this isn't a long-term thing for you?
No, it's not a long-term thing, no. Usually interims come in and, you know, look at solving the immediate problems, but really, you know, we're getting a handle on those things. You know, we have great people here, and so, you know, I would envision that by no later than the fall I'll be out of here. One thing I do know, I don't want to be driving here when we have weather.
Correct.
Because I well remember how much snow we get.
So your career then has taken you into many struggling school systems.
A few, yes.
You're tasked with not only finding out what the problems are, but also how to learn to ask the right questions, correct?
Right, correct. There's no doubt that I've honed the skill of, you know, looking. I tend to get to conclusions rather quickly because if you know the right questions. And let me speak first about the financial issues, because I think that perhaps social media, whatever, people talking about it, that there has been a concern that we're in really deep trouble. Well, we're not in really deep trouble, but I can tell you as a practicing superintendent, if I lost enrollment in a year, we immediately went to the budget and did adjustments within the existing budget, because you want to keep adjusting. Just like if you get more enrollment, you try not to tell anybody there's extra money because they'll want it. But, you know, you have to adjust. Well, as we have lost enrollment over time, we were not making those adjustments. However, we had, thanks to Dr. Hunt, a sizable cash balance. But it's just like at home. If you lose some hours, you're working somewhere and you have less hours and you're getting a smaller paycheck, you might have a little bit of money in a bank account, but if you keep relying on that, sooner or later, the bank account's gone. Now, we weren't in danger of that in any way, but if we had stayed on this trajectory, at some point, we would have had trouble. So it was a matter of adjusting where we may have had more staff than we needed, Sometimes we hold on to things. You know, we can't run classes with 4 and 5 children in them. So they weren't, so really, as we're looking at staff reductions, it's going to represent about 2% of our total employee base. So it's a very small number, 20 to 22 people. So today I sent a message out to staff, in addition to saying happy spring break. But by the way, I want everyone to calm down. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about massive layoffs.
Because there is a lot of anxiety.
Exactly.
Right now.
When you hear, we haven't had RIF here in a long time. And so it was important to me to communicate that this is, and these aren't all, you know, these are overall positions. They're not all just teaching positions, but it's a small number. And so I want people to just relax. And I don't want them going off spring break thinking they have to get a job tomorrow, because that's not the case.
Nor do you want people to leave artificially.
Because they may think they're the ones being targeted and then find out their department wasn't even being considered. And so we're working through things about contracts and who's more senior and this and RIF. And we were just meeting, in fact, before we came here today with our attorney, Mr. Kaminsky, to make sure we understood the law. So we'll be having those conversations. And in April, I'll ask the board for permission to issue those RIF notices. But we're looking to be that to be around after May 15th that we will notify people. And I always carry the RIF notices. I don't ask anybody else to do that because it is really a district decision.
Real quick for our listeners, RIF
is
what?
Reduction in Force. Thank you. Yep. I'm sorry, I use those ABC letters and I forgot to tell you. So I think we're beginning to talk with people now so they know how it may affect them. And the other thing that's important to know, you know, we get resignations for other reasons. People decide to retire or they, you know, they move away. We're hoping then to place people in those positions to make sure that the impact is as minimal as possible.
So you're saying after May 15th, if somebody sees you walking towards them, they might start running?
Maybe. They could probably run faster than me, but we will have at least had a conversation with them after that time. Is the timeline in the law is May 1 to July 1 that we have to do a notice, but obviously
you want to give everyone as much time.
That's right, because if you're going to be impacted, you know, we want to give you adequate time to find another position.
So this brings up, again, many of the conversations that have revolved around these things have been budgetary types of conversations.
Sure, sure.
So as anybody knows with their personal budget, it's the same as a nonprofit or a governmental or business budget. Mm-hmm. If you don't have enough revenue, your options are to find a way to get more revenue or to cut a budget, right?
That's pretty simple. You either have more revenue or you reduce costs.
And so it sounds like, and with schools specifically, revenue is tied to amount of students,
right? Absolutely, $8,600 a student.
So let's talk first about where you think budgets are going to. We talked about the reduction in force, maybe 2%, but that probably won't account for all of the money that we need to cut. Correct.
We're looking at other things beyond just staff, and I don't have a feel yet for all of that because. But it will certainly make great progress. I think that Dr. Hunt, and I know there's been a lot of speculation about somehow no one's taken any money. He is probably one of the finest people you would ever know as a CFO. He's been with us a long time. But it's just like, for example, even though I've been gone from here, my accountant is still John Angelos, who is here in the And when my husband and I would sit down with John and he'd say, you guys need to do less of this, more of this, whatever. He's making a recommendation. He's not following us home to see if we do it. Well, it's the same thing with a person who's in the role of CFO. They put together a budget book. They include all of the information. They make recommendations, but they're not the people that have the authority to carry that out.
Who are those? Is that the school board?
Basically, the superintendent recommends to school board. So, you know, some of that information have been in prior budget books, but, you know, I think there was always some hope we were going to have more enrollment, things would get better. You know, you don't want to do things unnecessarily and then you get a growth spurt and then look what you did. So, you know, these are always hard decisions to make.
So then on the flip side of that, increasing revenue is, so the state of Indiana, we can talk about all of that, why, and that's a conversation right. for our legislators. However, they have made our education system a marketplace,
right.
correct?
It's choice.
We have school choice, which for parents, many parents love it. It certainly, though, makes schools competitive with each other.
It does.
And so the way to increase revenue then is to get more students to come to your school or
right.
to stop losing students.
Right.
President Seberg in the last meeting talked about how many students have went to New Prairie, and our, a lot of the local rural schools have gotten significant. I think New Prairie has gotten $1.2 to $1.5 million dollars mm-hmm. worth of revenue from mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. How can the school system shore up that leak? Mm-hmm. And then what to do to maybe even attract students from other schools.
Right. Well, first of all, I think if you look at the state database on all school corporations, you find that this is not unusual to LaPorte. If you go to more affluent areas like Noblesville, Carmel, Hamilton Southeastern, they lose a lot of kids for other reasons, because choice is that, you know, what a great thing for parents. So we need to earn their respect to want to send their kids. So the marketing issues, and that's something we've really focused on. We know that there's, and listen, since time immemorial, parents, I worried about my daughter when she was going to go to middle school. But now middle school is 7-8. People don't realize in the 5-6 that it's a building, it's separate, it has a bridge, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, an area. But fifth grade is elementary. Now, there are people saying, well, why did we move it? Well, it was done a long time ago. It doesn't matter. We're there. But it's run like an elementary classroom. They have two teachers. The teachers are with them. We haven't done a very good job of explaining that to mm-hmm. parents. So Mr. Wilson, who is the principal, will be going, be holding meetings not only at his school for parents, but going to, say, the fourth grade graduations to talk to parents about fifth grade. Because if you don't tell your story, people will assume bad things. They may worry that they're going to be mixed up with those seventh and eighth graders. You know, it's just all those rumors that tend to be untrue. But we really protect those kids carefully. Sixth grade is a little more freedom. But again, they're in another wing of the building. And, you know, we don't mix them up for those reasons. So we have to do a better job of telling our story. But the other thing, I think the home run that we're going to be able to hit is with our career and technical education. You hear CTE. What I remember about LaPorte so well, we are a community of hard-working people. And with college costs the way they are, people are looking for, I want my child to be able to graduate and perhaps already have some type of industry certification to work. I had a bus driver. I was meeting with bus drivers a couple weeks ago, and she told me a young person who graduated a year in the ag program where they learn welding earned $54,000 in the first year. Now, that probably was a little overtime, but really, out of high school, people don't know or understand that today the push from the state are these career pathways, mm-hmm. and kids can not only earn something that's an industry certification, but they can get what we call dual credits. So they take a high school class and the syllabus is aligned with a college class, so they get dual credit. That means you get college credit for a real bargain compared to what it would be if they go there. And you can, we don't have all those things in place yet, but eventually they'll be able to earn an associate's degree based on taking dual credit. We have to prepare for that because you have to get everybody licensed. But even without that, if they don't want to do college credit, for example, we're going to revitalize building trades for next year, building houses, carpentry. I mean, there's a million skills, technology. I mean, smart houses now with all the technology. So we haven't explained that connection, I think, as well as we could. So right now we're doing video presentations to put on the website. We are having young people talk about how this has impacted their lives, kids that have been successful now in seeking these pathways. And, you know, we have, you know, about 18 of these, and we're going to keep expanding those. Because I think when people realize this is the place to come, we not only have ag science, we have education pathways, we have culinary, we have all those pathways and whatever. Because most of the time, if your child is not going on to some kind of higher education learning or going to the military, you want them to be able to not just get a job, but get a job where they can earn a little better wage. And so that's our focus, and that's the focus of the state of Indiana. I don't think we've done a great job of telling that story.
It's really interesting that you say that, Dr. Hinckley, because being in media for as long as I have, hosting a radio show, it has been my experience with LaPorte Community School Corporation is that they're the most afraid of public comments and public interaction.
Okay.
And I always thought that that was a detriment because I would much rather create the narrative than actually have to abide by the narrative already given to us.
Sure.
And I've appreciated that you have been out there, even though it's not always the easiest thing to talk about because you are tasked with a lot of things. Do you think, though, that in the future, after you're gone, do you think that is something that LaPorte should continue to do, though, be aggressive in their media strategy? And continue
We have to be aggressive in our media strategies because that's what people pay attention to. It's how they get their news.
Mm-hmm.
How people learn about these things. Otherwise, it's the rumor mill.
Yep.
And I learned long ago, especially when I went to the Indianapolis market and dealt with their media, that if you don't tell your story, somebody will make it up.
Yeah, somebody's going to tell it for you then.
And they'll tell me for us. And so, to me, in the Kingsford Heights is a great example. We needed to give people an opportunity to tell us what they thought. On the numbers, if you just look at the numbers, when you have 117 general ed kids, and then we had several special education classrooms, so a total of 140, anybody working in a school corporation would tell you can't keep a school open with 140 kids. So by the numbers, most expensive school to operate. But what I know from being here before, I've been to those school Christmas programs there. I see how parents love this school. Very hard decision. But when you have to deal with budget cuts, mm-hmm. you sometimes make hard decisions.
Again, you either increase revenue
or
you cut budget.
That's right. Right. So what are we going to do here? Well, I think that the overwhelming, and bravo to the Kingsford Heights community, that they impacted how the board was looking at it. So there was never a recommendation to close. It was that we needed to take a look at it. So then when it became clear that, and I think the key is we have a builder out there who's building, I don't know if all those houses will have children in them. I hope a couple of years from now we're going to be in better with better numbers. But the challenge, of course, Kingsford Heights, when the KOP Circle had 20,000 jobs and we had a lot of people out there, it made sense. But the challenge there, it's such a remote location yeah. that's what makes it hard. So now that we're not closing the building, which would have saved probably $650,000, we're now looking at how can we repurpose half of the building.
Okay.
So I'm not ready to talk about that yet because I've had I got three meetings in 2 days, and we're trying to figure out all the rules about some things.
So then now, actually, for our listeners in Kingsford Heights, actually what this might turn into is actually an added benefit to them
exactly.
because there might be something
exactly.
else out there in that
exactly.
building, correct?
Yes, and so we need to look at that because I don't know that we can have a magic wand that suddenly we're going to get another 100 kids. We're not.
Especially tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I mean, not tomorrow, because I need them like tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think then we have to look at other ways to repurpose that portion of the building to see if that will bring in some other revenue. And because as you said, we're back to either increase revenue or reduce costs.
Yeah. And so is there, I mean, I guess, is there other schools? Because I know our listeners are going to want to know, is there other schools? Is the kids' schools that they go to, is that being talked about as well?
No, we're not talking about any other school closures. Our other schools are fine. There are things like, for example, these seem like simple things, but I actually had a parent email the first week I was here about why didn't we offer early entrance to kindergarten and preschool? Well, I was a little surprised we didn't. Everybody does that. Well, we didn't. So guess what? Now we are going to do that because it makes sense that for parents, especially if their children have been involved in early education, they're ready. They should, we test them. They can come in early for preschool or come in early for kindergarten. I think they have to be five. I think it's August 1. But that's, we just sent that out. Those are little things that as parents are trying to figure out. Child care we know is pretty expensive, and you're trying to look at that. You think your child's ready. Well, we should try to accommodate that. So, but getting kids back, first of all, we have to understand why they've left. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes kids leave because of they drop out or they do those things. So, for example, I recognize, and you all do as well, that we have a lot of anxiety in this world right now. Mm-hmm. People will say it's a leftover of COVID. I'm not that kind of a doctor. I don't know that. But for whatever reason, and we have children that for whatever reason find, even though our school environments aren't large, if our elementary class sizes are excellent, you know, 17 to 25 at most, and many of them are small. That's important for us because we've got some ground to make up to improve our academic scores. And we're focusing on some processes. We just had some training this week that we have to be ready to go, and we have to get ready to be so we can get better because people look at scores. But additionally, though, as we're trying to figure all of this out, we just have to make sure that if a child is not in an environment that works for them, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that, that if they need, we have right now what we call the homeschool online where they're enrolled all the time. But we need now for an individual course, or let's say it's a child who makes a mistake and they're out for the rest of the semester. Well, they need to be able to regain those credits and work. We need to have all those options, but we need to market them.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because I'll get anecdotal about my own experience. So last year, my daughter had some health issues. And so we knew that this year, between some of our healthcare needs, we were going to have to do some kind of hybrid opportunity.
Exactly.
Between. And LaPorte said they could not do that. But we had two other school systems locally that said they would.
That's right.
And she can still play sports. She can. We'll figure this out, essentially, right?
Right.
Is that a part of, do you think, the path forward, really, for all schools? Because, again, it's this marketplace of competition,
yeah,
right?
If two school systems told you they were going to work it out for you and we didn't, then we missed an opportunity there. Because we didn't have things in place.
The
now we're getting
right?
them in place. You got to have the structure. So now that'll be something we market to help people know that we have that flexibility. Because there are a variety of reasons why people need a different situation. And listen, we have to accommodate those things because we would want that for ourselves, for our own children. And so those are get betters for us.
It certainly creates more work for you, though, right?
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
but again, it's a marketplace now.
It's
right?
a marketplace. Listen, if you're going to compete, got to hustle. And you have to be able to look at where we have holes or where we're less competitive. You know, let's applaud South Central and New Prairie and Westville. They've done a good job of marketing things. You know, sometimes kids leave because grandma lives over there or, mm-hmm. you know, there are a variety of reasons. But sometimes it's because they've had a bad experience here and they're trying to find a better one somewhere else. So I think one of the things, now when you get with older children, they generally don't let you know they're not coming back. They just don't come back. But we have to recognize there are a lot of life circumstances that we don't need to be the judge, jury, and executioner. What we need to say is, look, what can we do here to get you to the finish line? Because we want you to graduate. If that's doing a GED instead of regular classes, then we should do that. If that means that we are looking at, you know, you need to take these courses over and you can do that online. You know, we just need to make those accommodations. And I think our neighbors have obviously done a good job with that. And we need to up our game.
Yeah, one of the things I tell my team at work is, let's default to yes, right? Let's figure this out, right? Now, you might end up following that path down and you realize there's a no at the end of that. But let's try to say yes.
I think that's good advice. Start with yes. Start with, let's look at this and see how we can make
let's
it work.
Let's make it work, whatever
let's
we can.
Let's make it work, whatever we can do. Because, you know, that's just the world we're in today. And, you know, if I'm a parent and I have a child that has some whatever has happened, whether it's health needs, whether it's anxiety, I mean, all of those things, we want that child to be successful. But that's a parent decision. how they want their schooling to go. So I think you're right. Let's start with yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you have been here in the school system. Mm-hmm. You obviously, you said your daughter graduated from LaPorte. You're still connected to LaPorte in other ways. What do you see has changed from the time you started working here in the community to where you are now, when you've come back here?
Well, in my whole 5 weeks here.
Yeah. I'm going to have you diagnose everything.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Well, I think that some of the challenges we continue to find here, I know that, you know, the city is looking at housing and
growth, right?
Growth, those kind of things. Because what I remember from my 12 years here back then was, I remember someone said this to me, that we're just far enough away from Chicago that people who want to look at a bedroom community aren't going to come all the way this way. They're going to stop in Porter County, and that, of course, is why they've had that growth. But we have many things to offer here. This is a community of connection. I always remember how much support our kids got in their athletic competition. Even when we were terrible, they still showed up. You know, when we would go to Penn, who is our archenemy, we traveled more than Penn did, and we went to their house. So there's always been a lot of support for youth, and there's a lot of youth activities here. But I think the question becomes here how we have to continue to evolve to help our community understand that kids have to be in school every day. We're struggling with that a little bit. Our attendance rates are not what they need to be. We have a growing cultural challenge with a lot of our families where English is not their natural language, and how we communicate with them. That is more prominent today than it was when I was here before. But a lot of the good things about LaPorte are still here, how much it's changed. I think it's in that period of getting ready to evolve, but we're not there yet. But you know this, anything that happens in a city, the other thing they look at is the quality of the school system.
It really does impact economic development.
Absolutely.
It impacts everything.
If
people don't want to send their kids to the school, they'll work here and live somewhere else, correct?
That's correct. They will.
And then that impacts everyone. I want to talk, so we talked about all of the things that that we're working on, the school system's working on. Mm-hmm. You talked about maybe vocational, education being a more prominent feature going forward. What are the things that you think LaPorte school systems does well today? Like, what do you think they do well? What are our strengths as a school system?
Well, we've done a lot of work with, right now, working with some of the mental health issues that kids have. This really wasn't on the platform when I was here before. And that is not to say that teachers are the only place where that goes, but we now have a lot of training in place where when we sense that there's a problem that's bigger than what we certainly can handle as a teacher, we have counselors, we have social workers, we have people from Swanson Center. So I think that has we have really worked hard to have a better place for that. For example, we have Slicer Champions, which are mentors that are in the middle school and high school. That's kind of a different thing. Certainly didn't have that. Well, my brother, he used to live in Indianapolis. He lives in Connecticut now. He was a mentor when he was in Indianapolis at one of the high schools. And an older person, he's older than me, right? But he loved it, and he really enjoyed building that relationship. What we have to realize is that we have a lot of kids that don't have a significant adult in their life, and we're working really hard to create that. Because for children that don't have that stable family structure that maybe we had, if there isn't a significant adult in their life that they can talk with, they're going to maybe make a bad choice. And sometimes those choices are life-altering. So we've spent a lot of time, certainly since COVID, really focused on how to get our arms around kids to keep them focused and do a good job with that. We do a good job. We have all of the intensive courses, AP. We have lots of kids engaged in that. We have a lot of kids that are going on to, schooling. And so we've always done a great job with that and continue to do that. Our schools are safe places. We don't have, you know, we have two SROs, but we don't have people, you know, we don't have a thing where there's fear, you know. I mean, I worked in a place with a million square roof with 4,000 mm-hmm. kids in a high school. And we had three police officers all day because it was just a lot of territory. And it was a different community. So we don't have that. But, you know, we constantly are dealing with working. The thing about bullying has become, what is that exactly? The perception is it's everywhere. Well, should elementary kids have a phone where they can access that kind of stuff? That's a parent decision. I can tell you my two granddaughters in California who are, one's a junior and one's is a eighth grader. They have phones, but their dad's a police officer and they have no social media and he looks at it every day. Parents make those decisions, but that's a lot of the angst we get with kids. And then sometimes parents, you know, kids will say unkind things or whatever. That isn't necessarily bullying unless it's a repeat thing. Mm-hmm. So we continue to work hard to build on those things to get them. And we're not always successful, but I think we keep doing that. But we have safe schools. We have adequate resources to give kids what they need. And all of these programs that we now have, for example, serving children that, and it's not just children who are, that's Spanish, but, you know, where their English language is, we're getting kids in that we need to serve who may need that help, but then communicating with their families. But we have lots of activities, lots of clubs. I always believe that if you can create a sense of belonging for every child in the school, we'd never lose one. Mm-hmm. But they have to be in a group beyond just going to chemistry
yeah.
class.
Yeah, that word belonging is very important. If
Absolutely.
People can find a place to belong. I think adults or children, it makes a big difference
right,
in feeling meaning and purpose in life. A couple more questions, then we'll let you go. But one of the things I see most online, one of the, I guess, the if you want to call it a complaint, is our busing situation
oh,
in the poor
yes.
communities. You hear this. All right. So
I do. I've spent a lot of time learning about busing.
And I'll confess, I think in the last 2 weeks, 5 days, my kids' bus have been canceled to them. So now they still have it, obviously, if
no,
they
I
stay
know.
At the school. But
well,
but
one of the absolutely because I read all the I don't look at social media, but I looked at the when we did the strategic planning.
Yep.
There were a lot of comments, and I read all of those. Busing now, I'm not going to use the cop out. Everybody's having a problem. They are, but
sure.
that doesn't solve it when your kids
yeah.
got late 5 days. So we are going to. I don't know how this is going to work with 185 square miles, but we are going to look at three-tiered busing. Now,
what does that mean?
What that means is currently we have two, there are two runs.
Okay.
Now we would do three runs, which
oh.
means it would change the start of time for everyone, but it would mean less buses. You have to
yeah.
have less buses. So I'm not sure with 185 square miles. I remember when I came here in 1989, Ike Tallman was here at the time, and he was taking me around. And at 10:30, I'd only been to three schools, and I thought, my Lord, what have I done? Big place. And that's the challenge. The advantage we have is we have one high school and one middle school, intermediate school. So when you don't have multiples there, it's helpful. Well, we can't get our head around it, so we'll hire the company that knows how to look at weather routing. Carrie Brinkman does a great job, but here's what happens. First of all, early on, back when God was a boy and I had my first administrative job was curriculum, it was in a small district. They said, by the way, you're going to do the buses. I went, those big yellow things? Okay, well, I had to learn all about transportation. Well, I actually drove an empty school bus. Let me tell you something, and I didn't have any screaming kids on it. It was intimidating. It's mm-hmm. a big vehicle. So what Mr. Brinkman tells me is that he'll get people in that they'll do their background check and they pass. Now they have to get the physical and they have to take the test because you have to have a CDL and they fall out there for some reason. Now you can retake that test multiple times, a CDL test, or maybe they have some health concerns, they're concerned they won't pass. So we get them in the door and probably more than half of the people that come in end up not finishing. To do that. And so, you know, the challenge of being a bus driver, in addition to the fact that you're working with, you know, you have kids on a bus, building relationships with them so you have good order and all of that. But, you know, the other problem is, of course, is that, you know, it'd be like a classroom teacher sitting in the chair with their back to the whole group and you're trying to drive. So, you know, that is a challenge. So we think we've got enough subs and then people fall out or they get sick or things happen. So to just say we're going to keep trying harder is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to look at three-tiered. Now, if that doesn't work, we have a contract with bus drivers. We have a union there. So we might need to explore some other options, but obviously it would take a negotiations to get that done.
Yeah, that makes sense. So like you said, there's a large footprint that the school system has.
But it's a legitimate concern. When your kids are missing instruction all the time, I understand that. And, you know, they can go to another district and they're smaller and they don't have those issues. But we're big and we do. So, but we can't just keep hoping. We got to try something. So first we'll look at three-tier and see if that works.
All right.
So that would be three runs in a day,
yeah,
which would change
the elementary start time. Might start a little later. Middle school might start,
yeah,
you know. And
yeah, we got to make it all fit.
Yeah. All right. Just two more questions. First one.
Didn't he just say two more before
I don't count real well.
Okay.
I went to New Prairie.
All right. We'll figure
so the school board is looking at hiring a new superintendent,
right?
You're an interim,
right.
You said likely probably by fall, you're not going to be here much longer than that before the snow comes.
Before the weather.
What advice would you give to that new superintendent that is taking this position, and what things would you encourage them to focus on first?
Great. Well, first of all, I would tell you, by and large, the staff, especially at the district level, who I'm most acquainted with, but even people in the buildings, we're really fortunate to have a lot of talented people who've been very committed here. Because if that isn't there, that makes the superintendent's job a lot harder. So I think that I learned many years ago, I heard someone say this, the job of the superintendent is boardsmanship. It's building people and exceptions. So learning, we have four new board members with about 15 months of experience, and they're learning about what it is to be a public official. And then you have three members with lots of experience, and we'll have an election in the fall. I don't know who may run again or not. But I think a very important thing is how well you communicate with them to keep them together as a group, so you know what they're looking at and no surprises. That was always my rule with every school board. Don't surprise me, I won't surprise you. So you work hard to build that because they're the governing body and they're the ones that drive things. So sometimes you have to work with them. Sometimes if they're confused about issues, you got to pull back a little bit and then get more information. So first of all, just because they're young, I mean, young and experienced.
Yep.
And knowing that we may very well have some new members. I think that as I do some of the heavy lifting things, which will allow them then to more look programmatically at how we can be more competitive. And I think, you know, that's what interims do. You know, you kind of clear the deck and then run. So,
and then the final question is to our educators, to our staff. I know there's a lot of anxiety out there. I hear it in the public. What would you tell them right now?
Well, what I told them today is I sent them all a message, and I've done about three or four of these. I think they're a little surprised about that because, you know, I think everyone claims we're not very transparent. Well, if we don't tell them anything, they don't know what to do. So, and Erin here, who's quietly in the back, is my savior because she helps me word things in a better way than, whoop, you know, right away. So today we felt it was important to send out a message. First of all, enjoy your spring break. But second of all, please understand that as there's been lots of conversation about budget cuts and staff reductions, it only represents about 2% of our total population of employees. So it isn't just teachers. And so the likelihood it's going to impact you is very small. So I don't want you to worry about that. I want you to have a great spring break. Come back because we have testing when we come back, and we want to hit the ground running. So That's what I would say to them now. Now, there are actually a few of them that remember me, which means from before, not many. But when we had teacher discussion last week, the room was filled because they all want to know who the new person is. So I think working hard to build that trust with them is important right now. But we're trying to do that so that they know that we're moving forward in a measured manner and that we're trying to make the best decisions to allow us to bring back some of those kids, but to provide the best circumstance for them to be able to do their job.
And I genuinely believe everything that is broken right now can be fixed.
Absolutely.
Correct?
Absolutely. You know, things are almost always related to communication and whether we're telling people what's going on, whether we're listening. Listening is an important thing. If that parent hadn't emailed me about early entrance into preschool and kindergarten, I would not have known that, even though that's a pretty routine thing in most districts. So, you know, when I asked and they said no, I went, really? We should be doing that. Well, now we're doing it. Yeah. So it's being a good listener. It's being able to communicate. And people can understand, even when you make unfavorable decisions, if you explain to them why.
Yep.
If there's a logic to it.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on again. I appreciate how communicative you've been, and not just today in the podcast, but also just in general. I think more communication is always better.
Always
and
better.
And I appreciate
That's
that
right.
you've done that. And I thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank
today.
You. I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, today we have a very special guest joining us for a segment that we're going to try to bring to you each month. Joining me today is Brett Bimbersi, the Civic and Events Director for the City of La Porte. Brett's kind of the mastermind behind the events at the Civic Auditorium. You've probably noticed there's a lot more of them now than there used to be. It's kind of a cornerstone of community gatherings, music, and events here in La Porte. And he plays a pivotal role in bringing these experiences to life in our city, from concerts featuring really talented cover and tribute bands to weddings and community events that mark important milestones and moments in our lives. Today, Brett and I are going to talk a little bit about what's going on, giving a sneak peek into the upcoming concerts and events at the Civic. Whether you're a music enthusiast or searching for a venue for your next big event or looking for ways to get involved in the community, Brett is someone worth listening to. So without further ado, let us give a warm welcome to Brett Bimbersi. Brett, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me today.
Yeah, it's a
pleasure
good.
To be here.
Good to have you. So now we are recording this in March, but we'll release it in April. So I want to be really careful about the events that we talk about, that they're not past the point of, you know, what are going on. But you've been doing this job for how long now?
Well, I've been the Civic Director for about 9.5 years. I've been running city events, I think. Got blessed with that in, what, September of 21, I believe.
So it seems like that there was a shift in strategy, right? You've got this big civic auditorium that was donated, I think, by the Fox family or something in, like, 1900. Or, you know?
Well, actually, 1930. It's okay. Funny, we just had our 94th birthday Tuesday of March 19th.
And it was used prior to, I think, having a more strategic focus on the Civic Auditorium. It was used for some basketball things, but it wasn't necessarily as active as it is today.
Well, that's a bit of a misnomer, to be honest with you. When the Civic first opened in 1930, there were some articles written from 1930 to 1940. Little background, too. When the Civic first opened, we weren't just special for communities such as La Porte or South Bend or whatever. We were special in the Midwest and kind of nationwide because we had access to a major hotel within walking distance, which was the Rumley back at the time.
Okay.
And that was rare back in those days, the community planning, everything. So from 1930 to 1940, there's an article written that we pulled out of the archives. They estimated that there was 1.2 million visitors that came through the Civic Auditorium within that 10-year period. We opened March 19th of 1930. By 1940, same time, they're saying we had over 1 million people come through there back in those days. And we were a host to a multitude of different things, like, you know, there, you've seen pictures circulate on Facebook showing, like, the Veterans Day ceremony from 39.
Yep.
And, like, I mean, it was to the hilt. Every space on the floor had a chair on it.
Bringing in dignitaries, too.
Yeah,
right?
every seat in the balcony was full. These things happened all the time. When you mentioned the shift in strategy, I think what it was is as time progressed, the Civic has always been a rental facility. So promoters kind of fell off. You had to come in. You had to have a plan, just like a wedding or anything else. You came in. You signed a contract with the Civic Auditorium. We were the host facility. You did your thing, and you left. I came on in 2014. 15, 16, Mark Schreiber and the Park Board came to me and like, hey, like we need to do something to increase the revenue in the facility. With your background in food and beverage and the bar industry, we think it's time we get a liquor license for the Civic Auditorium so we can keep some of that money there to help pay the bills, renovate the building, and also lessen the tax burden on the citizens of LaPorte. So we did that. And then when Mayor Dermody came in, the mayor's like, I want to see the building busy. I want things happening. You know, I think you guys can handle this. So we went from being just a rental facility to now we're a venue where we do our own events as well. We still rent for weddings, baby showers, quinceañeras, everything, non-for-profits. You know, actually, we're holding one with State Street, mm-hmm. May 10th, I believe.
Yep. Locally. Yep.
Locally sourced. Yep. Which is going to be great. Stay tuned for information on that event. But, you know, like we have the New Day Foundation coming in April 27th. We're still home to the LaPorte County Symphony 4 or 5 times a year. You know, we keep our focus on being a rental facility, being there for the community. But at the same time, now we're augmenting that with putting on our own events. The Civic Concert Series is a great example of that, raising our revenue. Thing I can point out is like in, I think it was in 2014, our revenue for the building itself over the course of a 12-month period was about $120,000.
That's what you brought in from
renting
the facility out.
That's what we brought in. Yep. In 2023, our revenue was just over $800,000.
Wow.
Most of that growth has happened since 2022.
Because of what? The concerts?
Holding the concert series. In our growth, we've averaged about 50% growth every year for the last 3 years.
Can I talk a little bit about the concert? Because I have some questions about that. Because,
absolutely.
You guys are hosting concerts. So in April and May, what do you have coming up, for instance, for our listeners that might not know?
Let's see. In April, we have a private fundraiser April 6th. April 12th, we're hosting
for
Tennessee.
For the concerts, yeah. Okay.
Yes. April 12th, we're hosting Tennessee Whiskey. It's a tribute to Chris Stapleton. And then an Eric Church tribute's coming in with them as well. They're extremely popular in the Chicago area and the rest of the Midwest. I've talked to several groups that have seen them, and they say if you close your eyes when the Stapleton tribute's up there, you're thinking you're in the same seat. And Nate, you can speak from experience. I know you were at one of our shows.
I've been a couple.
The Pearl Jam show.
I'm going to tell you. That's what I want to talk about. Yep. So I want you to bring them back. Because,
absolutely.
I had some diehard Pearl Jam fans, friends that were there,
mm-hmm.
and some of them said it was as good, if not slightly better, than the Pearl Jam concert itself. They
yes.
were so good. And you know what I loved about it is I came in half hour before the concert. I was home a half hour after.
Yes.
And I was there with maybe 10 of my buddies, and we had the best time. I mean, my friends still talk about this. It was a year and a half ago, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We still talk about that concert as being a highlight of our event, you know, that we did together. But so then the question for me is, you've got all these tribute bands, you've got all these things, you're navigating these calendar. How do you make a decision of who you're going to bring in?
Well, lots of research goes into this. Of course, you know, I'm one of those people, my Facebook timeline, the Civic's Facebook timeline, our message center, like we're always getting, you know, hey, what about this group? What about that group?
Oh, I'm sure.
Since as soon as we started our first show under our like sponsorship or running of it was the Wildflowers out of Georgia with a Tom Petty tribute out of Georgia with small town over out of Northwest Indiana.
Station is Mellencamp, right?
Yep. And they blew the place was packed. We had a great time. As soon as we had that concert and word got out that we were hosting our own shows now, I get emails every day from promoters, from agents, from bands wanting to come to the Civic Auditorium. One of the great things about being in the Midwest is we catch some routing. Like there's a lot of great places, you know, over in the Chicago area, Detroit, like smaller towns,
yeah,
like Traverse City,
a lot of cities,
Grand
right?
Rapids. Yep. And if you watch those, even stuff in Indiana, like the Honeywell down in Wabash, the Blue Gate, which is a little close, but, you know, it's a big area up here. We have a nice population base. And it sometimes it's a little bit of luck. Sometimes it's a lot of research online. Like, I'll just sometimes, you know, best tribute for Journey, and then, like, start combing through websites and reviews and things like that. But sometimes we've been lucky. I'd say we've hit almost 100%. Maybe not on the great attendance, but definitely I have not had a tribute yet that's come in and I've been disappointed in.
So then how do you make a decision? So I saw the Four Winds is bringing in a Taylor Swift tribute, right? So this has got to be huge right now because nobody can get Taylor Swift tickets,
you know,
right? So I'm sure they're charging like crazy if they're good. But so how do you decide whether or not to do a concert for, let's say, a younger audience or demographic to, you know, this group here wants to see, you know, a band from the 70s that they loved, a tribute band. Mm-hmm. How do you balance that?
It's tough. One of the things I always try to do is filter my opinion out of it.
Yeah.
Which is really hard to do sometimes. I love music and I love all genres. Like when I was in college, I can remember in Bloomington going into the local music store and I would buy stuff from like Zydoscope, crazy like Louisiana Cajun to Neil Diamond to like Beethoven. And at the time, I think it was Digital Underground and stuff like that. And they look at me like, are you crazy? I'm like, I like everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like was raised in that kind of house, that kind of thing. But we're trying to grow our base, I guess would be the way to put it. It seems like our sweet spot so far has been the classic rock type Styx, Journey, Queen,
mm-hmm.
the Fleetwood Mac show we had, our rumors for a Fleetwood Mac tribute in November. Oh, my Lord. The lady sounded, I won't say better. She was Stevie Nicks up on the stage.
Yeah.
They were that good. People enjoyed it. We had a Prince tribute a couple of years ago. Great entertainer, great job. The only one licensed by the Prince Foundation in this world. Stuff like that. Queen Nation blew the doors off a year ago. We've had an awesome AC/DC Thunderstruck we've had luck with now twice. But we're trying to expand things. Like by the time this airs, we will have hosted an Ozfest, which is different for us.
Yep.
The Tennessee Whiskey is going to be our first country venture. Like for the Civic Concert Series.
Country, yep.
Definitely modern country. And then like later in the year, actually June 23rd, we have a rescheduled Little Mermaid concert.
Okay.
This Little Mermaid is a tribute to all the Disney music and songs that your kids drive you nuts with at home or your grandkids. You know, they play everything from Aladdin and Frozen and Jungle Book, and they dress the part. Like they literally dress up like princes and princesses and do costume changes. It's licensed by the Disney Corporation. We're bringing that in June 23rd specifically for a kids show. June 9th, we were lucky enough to grab a Neil Diamond tribute. Extremely popular on the West Coast. They're called Super Diamond. Close friend of mine around here had seen them a couple times, contacted me, told me, hey, they're doing private parties in Chicago this weekend. You should see if they'd come down. And like we just put tickets on sale and we've almost, you know, we've sold a lot of tickets for that already. So it's tough to like kind of venture. And one of the things I always try to do too is, you know, when we're doing these shows, and I guess the elephant in the room always on stuff like this, we do not use taxpayer money to pay for concerts at the Civic. Point blank, that's what it is. The money comes out of our non-reverting revenue. It has nothing to do with the tax base. We have two separate accounts for that. The city's very good, and it's state law. Like, those monies stay separate. All these get paid for out of our non-revenue revenue-producing events.
Yeah, just real quick for our listeners, because they might not be steeped in the lingo.
Right.
What is a non-reverting fund for the government? This is an important
Basically, I think the best way to describe that is tax base at the end of the year. If you don't spend it, it just goes back into the general fund. Okay, so say we get budgeted $100,000 out of our general fund is what we call it, or the property tax base, et cetera. What you spend, and at the end of the year, it goes back to the city, and you have a new budget starting in 2025 or four, mm-hmm. whatever year have you. Our non-reverting budget is basically where our revenue goes into, and at the end of the year, if you haven't spent your appropriation, you don't lose that money. It stays in there. It's just like a checking account.
Yep.
And it stays with us. Like our individual departments get allotments. That goes back to the general fund of the city. Our individual department receipts stay with the individual departments.
And you guys, because again, you guys are revenue producers, right? You're trying to make money on these concerts. You're certainly not lose money on these concerts.
Right. And I mean, it will happen. I mean, we all know, like,
every promoter's going
to
have.
Like, I've told the mayor, like, looked him in the eye, like, if I was that good to guarantee we could have a profit on every concert, I would be probably making millions of dollars working for Live Nation or somebody else. But that doesn't exist. But we're very careful, and we make sure at the end of the year we're going to show a profit on these things.
And
I'll be honest with you, we've hit on 95% of our shows, which is great.
What is, let's say, for many of your shows, how many tickets are you usually selling? Are you getting to 1,000? Are you getting to...
Yeah, we've had probably 3 to 4 shows where we broke 1,000, and like that is really impressive for me, because when first started, we were lucky to get 200 or 300 up in the balcony. The Fleetwood Mac Rumors show we had in November this year, or last year, we drew almost 900 up in the balcony. I mean, we were 80% sold out in the balcony. Our floor does extremely well for anyone that's been to our shows. We generally have 400 to 500 on the floor for every show.
Wow. So let's get to, and again, I go to shows in Chicago. I go to, you know, the Aragon Ballroom, and they're not selling that many tickets. I mean, their venues just aren't as big.
Correct.
You know, and so that's fantastic. So let's sum this up for our listeners. For those that want to maybe attend an event at the Civic, some of the things, or maybe even participate in some of the stuff that's happening there over the next month or two in April and May, maybe even into June, because sometimes you have to get tickets pretty early. But you said you've got the Mermen coming in June.
Mm-hmm.
Tennessee Whiskey is when?
April 12th.
April 12th. So that might be done by the time I don't know when this is getting published. But and then you've got
May 11th. We have a Jimmy Buffett experience coming.
Okay.
Got high hopes for that. Same time frame when we brought
for
Queen Nation
heads,
in.
Yeah.
The Parrot Heads. Unfortunately, Jimmy Buffett's no longer with us. We think like this is going to be a great show, a great time for everyone. One of the things I love about our crowds that we draw to, and we've had even this with our Brew Fest that we host at the Civic, we've always gotten compliments at Brewfest about how well-behaved our crowd is, how it's a very social crowd. People come and have a great time. Like a lot of these vendors that come in from other breweries and that, they're used to going to Brewfest where people are like staggering out.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's just a completely different vibe, and I feel like we get that at our concerts too. In fact, some people come to our concerts and they're like, you know, there's almost too much socializing. Like I'm here to let you might have this experience mm-hmm. when you were there. You guys are at your table having a great time,
yep.
catching up and listening to the music. Some people just want to concentrate on music only. Some people want to get up and dance. I think we do a good balance of all three.
For sure. Any other events other than the concerts coming up that you want people to know about?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there are a few concerts in May we should probably throw out there. Yep. Besides for the Jimmy Buffett tribute on May 11th, we have Jump and Classic Rock. Jump is a great Van Halen, David Lee Roth era tribute that we've had in the past. And, man, they are outstanding. They're going to be there May 31st. June 9th, we have Super Diamond, which is the Neil Diamond tribute. And June 21st, we're going to be bringing in the Four Horsemen, which is another step in a different direction. It's going to be a pretty crazy weekend for us that weekend. Friday, June 21st, we're going to have a Four Horsemen Metallica tribute. And then Sunday, June 23rd, we're going to have the Little Mermaid makeup from January.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful. And then there's always events. Now you've got air conditioning, right?
Yep. We have air conditioning. We're still looking. We're pretty full through June. Still looking for some events for July and August. Then, you know, the event side, you know, we're going into the Friday Night Live season. Those start June 7th, Friday, June 7th, the night before the big cruise in La Porte.
Those are the downtown events.
Those are the downtown events over on the 600 block of Monroe. June 7th is that cruising. July 5th will be the return to Taco Fest. And then August 9th, we'll be bringing back Cheeseburger in Paradise, all in that area. We're going to rename the Friday night of the Lake Fest. Is going to be Friday Night Live at the lake, and that's going to be at Fox Park. We're still working on the details for that. And then Friday, September 20th, which is the day before the Sunflower Fair, we'll have Friday Night Live on the Ave, and that's going to be the night before Sunflower Fair. If everyone remembers the last 2 years, we've had Small Town playing. We're going to bring in a new band this year. I haven't quite figured out who that is, but that'll be that Friday night September 20th, and then the 21st will be the Sunflower Fair this year, the 25th annual Sunflower Fair.
Lots of things to get involved with, everyone. Summer's right around the corner, so again, where can people find this information if they don't remember, you know, just from us talking?
You can go to Living the Lake Life website for the city of LaPorte, and for all our concerts, to buy our tickets, everything, please go to laportecivicauditorium.com or give us a call at 219-362-2325.
Brent Bimmercy, it's always great to talk to you. I'm looking forward to it. We'll have you back here next month, and we'll talk about what's going on, because I know things are always changing at the Civic Auditorium. So,
well, thank you, Nate.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll get another guest here soon. All right, now it's time to shift gears and focus on an essential event for our democracy, the upcoming Indiana primary election in May. Joining me in the studio today is Heather Stevens, the LaPorte County Clerk. Heather plays a crucial role in ensuring that our elections are secure, accessible, and accurately reflect the will of the people. And with the Indiana primary quickly approaching, there's much to discuss, from the election logistics and what voters can expect to the measures in place to ensure the integrity of our voting process. In today's conversation, we're going to touch on all of these kind of changes that voters might notice in this election cycle, if there are any, and Heather's insight on the evolution of election security and her role in facilitating a smooth electoral process for everyone involved. So whether you're a first-time voter, and if you are 18, by the time election happens, I hope that is you, eager to understand more about the process, or a seasoned voter interested in what's new this year. Today's episode promises to be both insightful and essential listening for you. So, Heather, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. First things first, when is this? We are recording this in March, but the election is coming up, the primary. When is the primary election day?
Primary election day is May 7th. However, Indiana has early voting. So for all of April, you can vote early, and that will begin on April the 9th.
Now, you have been the clerk for, this is almost 4 years, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're up for election as well. But you have a position where, especially because it involves the election and things like this, where there's always rumors and things like this about security and all these kind of things. Take people through the process of what you do and your team does for the election. Obviously, we use voting booths, you know, where you're pushing your vote in there, these kind of things. But I've talked to you many times about this. Our elections are secure, right? And there's a process to follow that you guys have.
Our elections are very secure. That's probably election security is one of my top priorities. Our voting machines, even though they are electronic, they are not connected to the internet. And I get some people who say, no, they're secretly connected to the internet. No, they're not. Especially our machines are dinosaurs. They are so old. They are absolutely not connected to the internet. What is connected to the internet are those new electronic poll books. Rather than the paper poll books, the past couple of years, we've seen an iPad. That is connected to the internet. It's on a secure network. And the reason that they have to be connected to the internet is so that they can communicate with each other.
Which makes it more secure even, right?
Yes, yes.
Ironically.
Ironically, because we don't want somebody to go vote over at the Civic and then go over to the Moose Lodge and vote again. So the check-in has to be able to communicate. So that's what those iPads do.
So let's go into the setup, because I think it's really fascinating. I have seen it up close and personal now, because we have allowed early voting at our facilities. But you have a team that comes in. And they bring these machines in, correct?
Yes.
And what happens after that, and who's running that, and let's talk about the kind of back end user experience that your team does to make elections happen, especially early voting.
Yeah. So we do. We have a team. Early voting, it's a team of two. It's one Democrat, one Republican. They stay together. They work together the whole time. They usually get along very, very well, which is refreshing. But they take all of the equipment, they go set up. When it's time to start it, to start the election on the machine, and that will happen the morning that early voting starts. Usually I'm bouncing around to make sure that there are no issues, no hiccups. But they do 100% of the process together. So even though those machines are there, the election has not been started on them. People do not know how to start the elections on them. It takes a card. in order to start the elections on them that our poll workers have in their hands, they run a zero tape in the morning, just showing that there are zero votes on this machine.
Because, again, it's not connected to the internet.
It's not connected.
It's stored and logged in there, correct?
Yes. So it all stays within the machine. It's not dispersed out into the world anywhere.
And so then that team has to store that zero log, I assume, right, to show that there was no votes in that machine when they started that day, correct?
Correct. Both parties, both the Democrat and the Republican worker, will sign that zero tape showing us that there were no votes on that machine. They keep running totals on the machine. They'll run a total at the end of the day. They'll run a total, not the votes, just how many people have voted on this machine.
Correct.
They can't see any votes.
They don't know
nothing
who's winning.
Like that.
They don't know anything like that.
No, they don't know anything. We don't know anything. And we don't know anything until May 7th, until at the actual election day. So it's really interesting because, I mean, we'll have all this, but we can't see it. Nobody sees anything.
And so, and then also the facilities are locked, right? So these machines, not only are the doors locked, but the machines end up getting locked as well, correct?
Everything is locked up tight.
Yeah,
yes.
Multiple layers of locks.
Multiple.
Usually.
And I know you've been wonderful because not only did you let us use your facility, but then we come in and we're like, yeah, but you can't have a key to this room anymore.
Yep.
And again, Nate's just been awesome about it.
But I think, unfortunately, there are some people that don't feel like our elections are secure, but I think it's really important to trust the veracity and the safety of our elections and seeing it up close and personal. And I know you personally, so I know that you get pushback at times. I know there's groups that kind of cause a little fire sometimes about this, but I think it's really important to know that the process is secure and it is safe and your votes do count.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, there was a time we had a family member who ran for like a township board seat, and one of our kids had just started voting that year, maybe the year before. Well, she didn't go vote, and I knew this because, well, I was in voter registration at the time, so I looked, but she hadn't voted, and that family member lost by 3 votes, and I called her, and I said, hey, they just lost by 1 vote. And they know you didn't vote today, and they're on their way to your house. And she was in tears, which, I mean, I was totally, you know, just giving her some grief. But absolutely, every single vote in this county is counted, all of them.
And I am less worried, I don't know about you, but I am less worried about the election security because I've seen it up close. It's not that I'm not worried about it. I trust it.
Yes.
I am more worried about people getting out to actually vote, correct? Like, you know, like, because our voting totals end up being far lower, in my opinion, than they should.
I would agree with that. I think the municipal elections last year, I was a little disappointed because here we've done everything. We have brought in the vote centers. We've done the electronic poll books. We have the mobile voting unit, a month of early voting. And our turnout is still so low.
And you hear all the fodder online, right? As if people are dissatisfied or something. And then the turnout is as low as it is.
Every time I do WIMS with Rick Federighi, I always have to be cautious and give it the radio version. But if you don't vote, don't grumble, because get out there, let your voice be heard, make a change.
Yep.
If you don't like
your guy
something
or girl might not win, but at least you participated in the process, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're super passionate, get involved with a candidate. I mean, they're always looking for help. This is not easy.
Yep.
So
absolutely, and I just think it's vitally important because as online fodder, and again, I want to always, I think it's good to be involved, and I think a lot of our online groups and stuff like that are involved people that are trying to make sense of the things they see and experience. However, that doesn't change things usually. What changes things is people voting at the voting box and getting new candidates. And so if you don't like someone or something or an agenda or the vision that a candidate has, whether it's on the county or the city or the national election, then vote, you know.
Vote.
So I want to talk, you talked about voting centers. Another, you know, I saw an online comment about this, that voting centers are something. But you made the switch, and you're the election board is, you've got an election board also agreed to this switch. What precipitated the change to voting centers, and B, why do you think that was a good decision?
This has been oh, this was my baby. I spent my first year in office working toward a grant to get the electronic poll books, because without those, we never could have gone to vote centers. We also had the mobile voting unit in the works, but again, without the electronic poll books, how was that mobile voting unit going to work? So the poll books were essential. So once those were secure, I said, okay, now we need to open it up. I live in Hanna. I work in LaPorte. I'm a bad example because I'm working all day on election day. I have to vote early. But other people.
But there's many people like you, though.
Exactly.
Right?
I don't want somebody flying, you know, from LaPorte to Hanna to get there in 10 minutes when I know it's a 30-minute drive.
Yeah.
Because that's the only place in the county that they can vote on election day. So what the vote centers do, they open it up. So now, rather than the almost 60 locations, we've started with 38, is what our vote center plan says, throughout LaPorte County. The state said we were required to have 8 locations, and I thought, well, that's reckless.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's too few. So we opted for, you know, too many, and that's okay too. I want to see where people are voting. But what it does is it makes it so that you don't have to go to Hanna, or you don't have to go
to Rolling Prairie
or out to Wills Township. You can vote at any vote center within LaPorte County.
And yeah. So to clarify that, if you live in Union Mills and you work in Michigan City, wherever your closest vote center is, go there, correct?
Go there, yes. Yeah, and there are those people, especially out in the county, and they say, well, I want to go to my polling location. You know, I'd like to see the people. I like, then go, you know?
So how does that work, Heather? Because those, you know, you're going in, let's say you live in Wills Township, which is by Rolling Prairie. That's the township I grew up in. And you go to Michigan City because you work there and you want to vote at lunchtime. You might have a list of different candidates, especially when you talk about townships, these kind of things, than the Michigan City. So how are those things getting changed?
So that was the complicated part of all of this, because now...
Because we have old machines, too.
We do have old machines, and we have... Everybody thinks that LaPorte County has one ballot. Absolutely not. LaPorte County has 92 precincts. So we have 92 ballots. Right now, we have 92 Republican ballots, and we have 92 Democrat ballots. So it's a lot. We have every ballot on every single machine. So that's where it's been interesting to, you know, we have to quadruple check ballots now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, nope, you're still going to get the ballot for Wills Township in
Correct.
Michigan City.
Yep.
You're going to get a Hanna ballot in Michigan City. You're going to get a Union Mills ballot in Michigan City.
So when does early voting open up?
April 9th.
April 9th. People can start. And where can people vote early at?
So that is all to be determined tomorrow. We have ideas, but until the election board votes.
Because, again, the election board, made up of a Republican, a Democrat, and you.
Yes.
They have to talk about it. They have to work it through, decide whether or not this is a good location or not, and then approve it, correct?
Correct. And it makes it tricky because you don't want to break open door law. So we don't talk to each other outside of those meetings because we don't want to do anything wrong. So these are all decisions that'll be made publicly.
Okay. All right.
So it gets interesting.
By the time this comes out, though, which will be in April, where can people find that information at least?
You're going to be able to find that at laporteco.in.gov. Click on the elections tab and it'll be on that page. I'm certain both parties are going to put it on their websites. I'm sure that Access LaPorte County is going to put it out there. I mean, we're going to put it everywhere we can. It will be published in the newspapers along with a candidate list. I mean, we're getting everything out there.
Now, I think this has confused some of my friends who they might lean one way, right? They might be more liberal, they might be more conservative, but they don't feel like they're a member of a party. In the primary, though, you don't have to carry in your party card, right? There's nobody checking to see, are you a Republican or a Democrat? You declare your party when you go to vote on a primary. Is this correct?
That's correct. Indiana, I get a lot of phone calls. Well, I want to change my party affiliation.
Just vote differently the next primary.
And that's
correct?
What I say. Great. Go vote. Indiana doesn't do the party affiliation that way. You can change it up each and every time if that's what you want to do.
So if you've not voted in a primary, but you want to, When you go on election or either early voting or election day, they're going to ask you, do you want a Republican or a Democratic ballot? Now you get to only do one, correct?
You can only do one, and you have to do one or the other.
Yeah.
You can't tell me, well, I don't want either ballot. Well, then I don't have a ballot for you. So, and we don't ask anymore. Because on that iPad, we're going to turn that around to you.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you don't have to say one word. You simply, you're going to select which one you want.
That's really interesting because I know there are people that, again, they might be voting in, they might not feel strong about either party necessarily, but they feel strong about a certain group of candidates, right? And they want to have more, I'll just be candid here. There are more Republicans this year in local elections running than Democrats. And so there might be somebody that says, listen, I feel strongly about this group of candidates and I want to participate in picking who this is. And so they might not feel strongly about saying to the world that I'm a Republican or a Democrat, but they want to do that. So I think that's a smart change there.
Well, and I think it was one of the changes that I really liked about the electronic poll books and the vote centers. Because again, before you had the big paper books. So everybody that came in after you could see which one you selected.
Yep.
You had to walk around with a green or a yellow little tab that said which ballot you wanted. And there's none of that anymore. It is simply printed on a nice little ticket that's going to tell the poll worker what your name is, what ballot you selected, and what your precinct is so that we make sure that you get the proper ballot.
Now, I'm gonna be frank here. The the election board that you are a member of, a three-person election board, one Democrat, one Republican, didn't used to carry a big hammer. But now you guys have decided to enforce rules, right? Not create, but enforce rules that were already on the books in ways that lead to some fines, that lead to some, you know, and again, not necessarily creating these things, but just saying, if we have the rules, let's abide by the rules, correct?
It actually states that we are required to do these things. So for a long time, I mean, by not enforcing these, I hate to say they weren't doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And we do take our jobs very seriously because we take elections very seriously. So I know that there are a lot of people upset about the, you know, the fines that were issued through the campaign finance reports and things like that. But if you're not reporting, you're not being very transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of that is public information. So if you are required to fill out this paperwork, you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do it, you're going to get a fine.
I'm going to guess more people will do it in the next one, right?
I think
in the next
so.
Cycle.
Because
and again, I think it's important to say, yeah, but it was never done that way. But again, it wasn't done that way. That is true, but it was abdicating the kind of functions of that board.
Absolutely. When I came into the county in 2017, I would ask a lot of questions because I'm nosy. I need to know. I don't just need to know what to do. I need to know why I'm doing it. And I would say, well, why do we do this? Well, because that's the way it's always been done. And that is my least favorite answer.
Correct,
in the world.
Me too.
That doesn't mean that it was being done correctly. So I'm not one of those people afraid of change. I love change. I think it's healthy. I do get some pushback, and that's okay. Not everybody agrees. But I think if we're not changing, then we're not handling our responsibilities very well.
So I remember talking to you 4 years ago on the radio show about some of the goals, and you've got, you know, many of these things are implemented. You've got vote centers going. What do you think are the next evolutions for elections and clerkship in LaPorte?
Well, right now I'm so focused on the vote centers because this is our first countywide
election. You're a little nervous?
Election.
A little nervous?
Of course. I'm a little nervous, yeah. But I have a great team. And our poll workers are amazing, and I think it's going to be fine. I know it's going to be fine. But yeah, it's nerve-wracking, and everyone thinks that, you know, I just have a couple of dates to remember, and no, there's 100. And we're still putting together the polling locations. But I will say that, so my biggest thing right now is definitely making sure that the vote centers are well received and that everything runs smoothly. A successful election to me is not necessarily about who wins the election. It's just making sure that everything went as it should, which it seldom does, is what I've learned. Mm-hmm. So there's always, it's not if there's a little, you know, a little issue here or a little hiccup here. Those are going to happen. You just want to make sure that they're not major.
Yeah.
So.
And just because there is a hiccup at times doesn't mean that the election isn't still secure and have integrity, right?
Doesn't mean that at all.
There's lots of people, there's lots of machines, there's lots of moving parts, correct?
There's a ton of moving parts. So you're guaranteed that when we say a machine went down, it doesn't mean it's broken. It can never be. It doesn't mean anything ill will happen.
The Russians didn't get to it?
No, nobody got to it. It just means for some weird reason it quit working that day. Maybe something, I don't know.
And they're not
new
machines, correct?
They're not new. Yeah. And things do happen. And when that happens, we have a tech from MicroVote that we keep on hand on election day just for these reasons. Because whether that machine, you know, worked all day or not, there's votes on it and we need those. So that's where they come in. And now we have these, it's called a VVPAD, it's a voter verifiable paper audit trail. So you're going to be seeing more and more of these this time. And what this does is every vote that machine records, it's going to be on this piece of paper. So the voter is going to get to verify that, yes, these are the candidates that I wanted to select. So if we're ever audited, we know which piece of paper came from which machine and everything better match.
And the voter also knows that, again, these are where your votes went, right?
Yes, yes. So I'm big on, I want our voters to feel comfortable because we do have a really good system.
Yeah, I think so too. So whenever I hear, because it's multifaceted, it's multi-layered, it is, you know, there's lots of fail-safes in these kind of things. And so when I hear people oftentimes talking about it, I think they just simply don't understand all of the things that goes into it. So
definitely.
Is there anything you want our voters, you know, the citizens, the residents of LaPorte to know as we deal with the upcoming primary? Anything that they should know? Can they still register to vote? Where?
Yeah, registration closes April 8th. So if you are not registered, please get registered. If you're 17 and you're going to be 18 on or before, is it November?
Election day, I assume.
Yeah, right? November 5th is the general election day. So if you're going to be 18 on or before November 5th, register because you can vote in this primary.
So even if you're 17, mm-hmm. you can vote in the primary if you're going to be 18 before Election Day.
Yes. Yes. If your birthday is November 6th, I'm very sorry.
Yeah. You lost. So, you lost.
That is a
wait
bummer.
For another year. Yeah, that's really important. And also I wanted to ask, because I wasn't real sure, if you miss, let's say this episode is coming out, let's say maybe even after that day. I don't know when it's coming out, but Lindsay, our producer, would know. But let's say it's coming out after. I don't know. But you still want to vote in the general election. Can you register to vote after the primary for the general?
Yes. Registration. Okay. So in Indiana, registration closes roughly 30 days before the election. It's going to close April 8th. And then the primary is
then essentially open
May
back
7th.
Up May 8th, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. And yes, you'll have that opportunity after the primary to get registered for the fall election.
Yeah. So if you have not registered to vote, again, this is a big one. We've got national election. We've got obviously the presidential election. We've got a governor election. We've got all kinds of different things coming up for our state, but also locally. We've got commissioners, we've got council. So it is a big one to get involved with, find out which candidates you like and support, and educate yourself on that. And hopefully on this show we'll have more candidates on and things like this, but also LEAP does a candidate forum as well. Just get involved. Oftentimes now, these things, I know the League of Women Voters was, oftentimes these things are online. If you can't make it in person, find out online. And if you want to know more about a candidate, candidates typically love getting people to reach out to them and talk to them. So, but it is on you. Nobody can vote for you.
That's right.
So, Heather, I want to thank you so much for being here. We'll certainly probably have you back on the podcast soon to talk about elections. I appreciate you helping our listeners know not only do you encourage them to vote, but also know that this election is safe, it's secure, and it is ready for you to participate in.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, have a great day.
All right, we all have things to do, so let's conclude the third episode of the Plugged in LaPorte podcast. I send a big thank you to our outstanding guests today. Dr. Peggy Hinckley, who leads the LaPorte Community School Corporation in an interim role with great dedication and determination. Brett Bimbersi, who helps to shape our city's event scene and help all of us have a better time in the city of LaPorte. And Heather Stevens, who keeps the gears of the LaPorte County Clerk's Office running. Your insights and stories have truly enhanced our conversation, reminded us of the strength and commitment within our community. And to all of our listeners, especially to you, your engagement and enthusiasm drive the journey that we are on together. It brings us great joy to explore the stories that shape LaPorte and to highlight the individuals who are working hard to make a positive impact. If you have enjoyed what you have heard and would like to continue this conversation, please do us a favor. Subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your preferred platform. Also, feel free to share it with your friends and family or anyone else you believe would be interested in joining us and becoming curious, connected, and engaged going forward. None of this would be possible without the support of our fantastic sponsor, the LaPorte Economic Advancement Partnership. To learn more about their mission and the phenomenal work they are doing to foster growth in LaPorte, please visit laportepartnership.com. You can also connect with them on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn to stay updated on their latest projects and initiatives. The purpose of the Plugged in LaPorte podcast is to foster curiosity, to build connections, and truly engage with the details of our community. So let's maintain that spirit until our next episode. I'm Nate Laux, thanking you for your time, your openness, and your willingness to go on this journey with us. Stay curious, stay connected, and stay plugged in. We'll see you on the next episode, right here on the Plugged in LaPorte podcast.